crumpled cars. $10,000 was not a vast fortune, but we pretended it was. Seriously, though, she said, finishing off the last of her wine. The kids. College. Very prudent.
We have to.
She was right. College was expensive, and it never hurt to save for it, except it did hurt. It hurt us and our future, which could make everything better for all of us. I have a better idea, I said.
Better than our children's education?
Hear me out. I suggested we use the money to invest in ourselves. In the years since we were first married and had our kids, our economic situation had not improved much, neither had our careers. Millicent was stuck selling condos and lower-priced homes. The more experienced agents had all the higher-end listings and sales. My private lessons were held at the public tennis courts at the park, and the clients were not consistent. I proposed we do something about this. At first, it sounded like one of our ridiculous dreams. The Christmas gala at the Hidden Oaks Country Club cost $2,500 a ticket. But the gala was not just another party. It was a ticket to people we would not meet anywhere else. A new generation lived in the Oaks. Most never knew my parents or me. These were the people who could afford private tennis lessons and expensive houses. They would pay for our children's education.
Insane, Millicent said.
You aren't listening.
No.
She brushed off my idea with a wave of her hand. That made me dig in. We fought for a week. She called me a child, and I told her she was short-sighted. She called me a social climber, and I told her she had no imagination. She stopped talking to me, and I slept on the couch. Still, I did not give up. She did. Millicent claimed she was tired. I think she became curious. I think she wanted to see if I was right. We spent half the money on tickets, and then bought a dress and shoes for her, a tuxedo and shoes for me, and a luxury rental car for the night. Millicent also got her hair, makeup, and nails done. By the time we paid the babysitter, not much of the money was left. It was worth every penny. 6 months after the gala, I was offered a job as the tennis pro at the club. Millicent met her first wealthy clients at that gala and started to move up in the real estate world. In one night, we had skipped a good 5 years of grinding our way up the ladder. It was like automatically leveling up in a video game. We aren't wealthy, not like our clients, but that night moved us closer. And to this day, Millicent knows that it is because of me, because I decided what to do with that money. She is reminded of this every year when we go to the annual gala, although to be honest, I'm not sure she cares. 28. At first, it was impressive that Rory had figured out a way to blackmail me. I can admit that. I was more annoyed with myself for getting caught than with him for catching me. But now, he is starting to piss me off. I'm in his room. He is sitting at his desk. His computer is on, and Naomi is staring back at me. 48 hours have passed since she was named as the only missing woman left. Her face is everywhere, all over the news and social media.
Why are you looking at that?
I say, nodding to his computer.
You're changing the subject.
He's right. I am avoiding the fact that he has just asked for hundreds of dollars to keep his mouth shut about my non-existent affair. Or my one-night stand, I should say, because I did sleep with Petra.
How long are you going to keep this up?
I say.
How long are you? I saw you sneak out just last week.
It's impossible to think of Rory as a child when he talks like this. Despite his floppy red hair and baggy clothes, he does not look like a 14-year-old. He looks like my equal. I'll make you a deal, I say. I'll give you the money, and we both stop. You will never see me sneak out again.
And if you do?
If I sneak out again, I'll give you double. Rory's poker face falls apart when his eyebrows shoot up. He covers his surprise by rubbing his chin, pretending to think about my offer.
I'll be watching, he says.
I know you will be. He nods, thinks, and then says no to my offer.
I have another idea.
I am already shaking my head at him, pissed off. Before, I was on the verge, and now I am there. I am not giving you any more.
I don't want money.
Then what?
The next time you sneak out, I don't want money. I don't want anything,
he says.
But I'm going to tell Jenna.
You'd really tell your sister? He sighs. It is not one of those old man sighs filled with weariness and fatigue. This is a child's sigh, the kind that comes with a trembling lip.
Stop, Dad,
he says.
Just stop cheating on Mom.
Now I am the one who is surprised. The full impact of what he has said spreads over me an inch at a time until I have the whole picture. He is a child. Adulthood is still years away, and he is not even close. Now he looks younger than ever. He looks younger than he did the first time I lied to him, younger than the second and the third. He looks younger than he did the day I taught him how to hold a tennis racket, and younger than the day he rejected it for golf. Rory looks younger than he did yesterday. He is still just a little boy. This has never been about the money or the video games or even the blackmail. This has all been about what he thinks I am doing. He thinks I am sneaking out to cheat on his mother, and he wants me to stop. When I realize this, it feels like a shotgun blast to the stomach. Or at least how I imagine that might feel. It is much stronger than a punch. I do not know what to say or how to say it. I nod and offer my hand. We shake on it. I keep all of this from Millicent, just as I have all along. I don't even tell her that Rory has been reading about Naomi on the internet. The kids see it all anyway. It's everywhere. Josh is still covering the story and is on TV all day, for breaking news and on the evening reports. He is still very young and earnest, but now he looks tired and needs a haircut. For the past 2 days, he's been traveling around with the police as they check rest stops. That was where Owen kept his victims, in an abandoned rest stop, where he had hollowed out the building and turned it into a bunker. The police have been searching all of them, along with any bunker type of building on the map. They have not found a thing. Tonight, Josh is out on an empty road, behind him a fleet of police cars. He is bundled up in a jacket and a baseball cap, which makes him look even younger, and he says they are checking on another possible location. They have been searching farther and farther out, even way out east, near Gothy State Park. It is because Naomi is still alive. Josh does not say that. The police do not say it either. But everyone knows that if Owen is still alive, so is Naomi. He always keeps them alive, and he does awful things to them. Things they do not talk about on TV. Things I do not think about, because Millicent is doing them now. Or I assume she is. I assume Naomi is still alive, though I have not asked and have no idea where Millicent would keep her. The police searches make me wonder. The next morning, while I'm backing out of the driveway, Millicent comes out of the house. She raises her hand, telling me to wait. I watch her walk from the door to my car. She's wearing a slim pair of slacks and a white blouse with tiny polka dots. Millicent bends down at the window. Her face is so close to mine, I can see the tiny lines in the corners of her eyes. Not deep wrinkles, but well on their way. When she places her hand on the edge of the door, I see scratches on her forearm, like she has been playing with a cat. She sees where I am looking and pulls down the sleeve. My eyes go up to hers. In the morning sun, they almost look like they used to. What? I say. She reaches into her pocket and pulls out a white envelope.
I thought this would be useful.
The envelope is sealed. What's this? She winks.
For your next letter.
This tiny thing lifts my mood. I do not write letters, but Owen does.
It will convince them,
Millicent says. Whatever you say. She puts her hand on my cheek and strokes it with her thumb. I think she's going to kiss me, but she doesn't. Not out here in the driveway where any neighbor could see us. Instead, she walks back to the house as casually as she walked out, like she has just reminded me to pick up almond milk on the way home. I slide my finger under the flap of the envelope and open the corner. Inside, a lock of Naomi's hair. 29. Despite what Millicent said, I go back and forth about the lock of Naomi's hair. I wonder if it will make things better or worse. Although Jenna is no longer carrying a knife, as far as I know, she also is not eating much. She picks at her food, swishing it around her plate. She does not say much at dinner. We have not heard any blow-by-blows of her soccer practices or school days. I do not like this. I want my Jenna back, the one who smiles at me, the one who asks for something so I can say yes. The only thing she asks for now is to be excused from the table. If I send a letter to Josh, confirming that Naomi is Owen's victim, the search will only intensify. The police will go through every building within 50 miles to find her, and the media will cover every moment of it. But perhaps it is worse to not send the letter. Perhaps it's worse to let everyone wonder if Owen has Naomi, maybe forever. Because then Jenna will learn that people can just disappear with no one ever finding them. It is the truth, but maybe she should not know that. Not yet, anyway. Once again, Millicent is right. The lock of hair is useful. I go through several drafts of the letter. The first is too elaborate. The second is still too long. The third is down to a paragraph. Then I realize Owen does not have to say anything. The hair will say enough. They will DNA test it, and they will know it is Naomi's. All I have to do is wrap it in a piece of paper and sign at the bottom. Owen. The final touch is the cheap cologne. I dump the lock of hair onto my letter. 50 strands, 100, I don't know how many, but they are a couple of inches long. At one end, the hair is frayed with slight differences in length. The other end was cut so straight I can almost hear the scissors snip. I do not allow myself to think about it any further. I do not want to picture the look on Naomi's face when she sees the scissors. Do not want to imagine the relief she feels when only her hair is cut. Instead, I fold up the paper around the hair, put it into a new envelope, and use a sponge to seal the flap. I do not take my gloves off until the letter is in the mailbox. As soon as I drop it in, I feel a surge of adrenaline. Work should be an escape, but is not. Everyone is talking about Naomi, about Owen, about where she might be held and if she will ever be found. Kekona is in the clubhouse. She does not have a lesson, but is there anyway, gossiping with a group of women who are all old enough to be Naomi's mother. The men sitting at the bar stare up at the screen, at the pretty missing woman they would have liked to meet. No one is saying anything about Naomi's activities at the Lancaster. She has become everyone's daughter, sister, the girl next door. It is scary how fast this has happened. The others were not like this, especially not Holly. No one ever looked for her, because she was never reported missing. Millicent and I made that decision together. We never discussed it after Holly was gone. It never occurred to me. I was too busy thinking about not getting caught to wonder what came next. Days later, Millicent's mother called. Her Alzheimer's had not advanced to the point where she'd forgotten how many daughters she had. We never told her Holly had been released, but she knew anyway. She had called the hospital. That evening, we had our first date night. We'd never had one before. We used to make fun of the term, right up until it became useful. When I told Millicent her mother had called, the expression on her face did not change. Dinner had just ended, the kids were watching TV, and we were still at the table. Veggie burger patties piled with tomatoes and organic cheese, sweet potato fries, and salad. I was still picking at the fries, dipping them in the spicy pseudo-mayonnaise. "I thought this would happen," she said. I glanced behind me, making sure the kids were not around. In those days, I jumped at my own shadow. I was not used to breaking the law, much less killing anyone, so every little sound meant we were getting caught. Each day, it felt like I had aged a year. "We shouldn't talk about this here," I said.
"Of course,"
Later, when the kids are asleep. Even that made me nervous. We should go outside, or in the garage. We can sit in the car or something.
Perfect. It's a date.
Our first date night took place after 11-year-old Rory and 10-year-old Jenna were asleep. Millicent left the door to the house cracked, just in case they needed us. I assumed we would tell her mother we had not seen Holly. I was wrong.
We can't tell her that she's missing, Millicent said. They'll look for her.
But she won't find...
No, she won't. But she won't stop looking until she can't remember to.
So we lie to your mother? We tell her Holly is here, and she's fine? She shook her head. Millicent was staring at the dashboard, lost in thought. Finally, she said,
There's no way around it.
I waited, afraid I would sound stupid again. When Millicent said she wanted to pretend Holly was still alive, I remember thinking it would not work. After all we had done, and after all we had apparently gotten away with, this was the thing that would ruin us. We had not thought it through properly. We never even discussed it.
It won't work, I said.
Eventually she'll want to talk to her, see her. They'll come down or try to get hold of her. I rambled on, listing all the reasons this could not work. We could not claim to be the only people who saw or spoke to Holly.
I think Holly wants to get away, Millicent said. Probably because of me. Because I remind her of what she did and why she was put away.
I started to get it. If it were me, and if I wanted a fresh start, I might even leave the country.
I would definitely leave the country, she said.
Would you send your mother an email?
A letter, a long one, letting my mother know that I'm fine, that I just need some time to figure it all out.
She sent the letter almost a week after Holly died. Holly said she was going to Europe to heal, to find herself, to make her own way in the world, but she would check in regularly. Her mother responded, saying she understood. She even included a picture. It came from my phone, when I took a picture of Holly in front of the kids' school. The letter then came full circle when she showed it to Millicent during a visit. When my mother-in-law passed away, she no longer remembered either of her daughters. 30. I first see the report on my phone while sitting in my car outside a coffee shop. I am in between home and work, on my way back to the club after dropping the kids off after school, and I stop to get a cup of coffee. The breaking news alert on my phone goes off. Owen makes contact again. In the video, Josh talks about the latest note from Owen. For the first time in a while, he does not look tired. He is standing outside the police station. His cheeks are flushed pink, and his eyes are wide from excitement, not caffeine. After spending a week watching the police check empty rest stops and abandoned sheds, he looks like a new man. A picture of the letter flashes on the screen. Owen's name is clearly visible. This note was not the only thing I received from the man who claims to be Owen Oliver Riley. Wrapped up inside this piece of paper was a lock of hair. We don't know who it belongs to. We don't even know if the hair belongs to a man or a woman. DNA testing is going on as we speak, but as soon as we know anything more, we will bring it to you first. Josh brings in a young woman who says she is a friend of Naomi's, though again he points out that we do not know what happened to Naomi. The friend does not look familiar. I do not remember seeing her with Naomi in real life or online. This woman has a nasally voice that grates, and it feels like I am locked in my car with her. She claims that Naomi is sweet, but not cutesy. A great friend, but also independent. Smart, but not a know-it-all. And I have no idea what any of that means. She steps out of view. The camera pans over to Josh and then widens. A man is standing next to him. He is a big man with a mustache that makes him look like a walrus. Josh says he is an assistant manager at the Lancaster Hotel, and he worked with Naomi. Josh does not ask him to describe Naomi in one word, but he does.
If I had to describe Naomi in one word, It would be kind. She was kind to everyone, all the guests and all of her co-workers, always willing to help. If a guest needed something up in his room and room service was busy, she volunteered. If someone was sick, she would cover for him. Never asked for anything. Not for me, anyway. Can't speak for everyone.
A knock on my car window makes me jump. Trista. I see her and the reflection of her on the glass. The last time I saw her, she was drugged into a near coma. As promised, I never told Andy. Trista is smiling, motioning for me to roll down my window. When I do, she leans in to kiss me on the cheek. Her apricot-colored lipstick feels sticky. "Well, hey there," I say. She laughs. It makes her look younger, and so does the daisy print visor on her head. "Sorry, I'm in a good mood." "I can see that." I get out of the car and face her. Trista's eyes are clear, her pupils not too big or too small. Her skin is a faint shade of pink, like she spent yesterday on the beach.
"You look great."
"I am great."
Relief hits, making me realize how stressed I've been about her.
"I'm so happy to hear that. I've been worried about you."
"I left Andy," she says.
"Left him where?"
I look behind her, thinking he is in the coffee shop. "Really?"
"No. I mean, we aren't together anymore."
I cannot hide my shock. Andy and Trista married not long after Millicent and I did. We attended their wedding. Neither has ever hinted at trouble, not to me and not to Millicent. She would have said something.
"He didn't tell you?"
Trista says.
"No."
"Well, I did it. I left him."
I want to tell her I'm sorry her marriage has broken up, because I am, because they are my friends. But she looks so happy, I don't say a word. Trista rolls her eyes.
"It's okay. You don't have to say anything. But you know what? I never really loved him. Not the way you love Millicent."
She smiles, not embarrassed at all.
"It's true. I married Andy because he ticked all the boxes. That sounds horrible, doesn't it? Go ahead, you can say it. I'm horrible."
"I never said you were horrible."
"But you're thinking it. You have to. You're Andy's friend."
"I'm your friend, too." She shrugs.
"The lessons have to stop. I am sorry about that, but I can't come to the club with Andy there."
"I get it."
"You really helped me, you know," she says. "That day we talked helped sort everything out."
The talk helped me as well. Because of Trista, I knew things about Owen I would not have otherwise known and was able to write a convincing letter to Josh. But this is not what she means. "I didn't do anything," I say, maybe to convince myself I did not break up my friend's marriage.
"If you hadn't listened like that, I would never have gone on and on about Owen. No one wants to hear all that. They just want him to be a monster."
"Isn't he?" She thinks about this while sucking on her straw.
"Yes. And no. Remember I told you that sex with Owen was good? Not great, but good?"
I nod.
"Lie. It was great. It was fantastic, actually. Owen was... he was..."
Her voice drifts off. She stares out over the parking lot outside the coffee shop, lost in a memory I cannot see. It feels awkward to just stare at her, but it would be even more awkward to speak, so I don't.
"I loved him," she says.
"Owen?" She nods and then shakes her head.
"That sounds terrible. I don't mean I'm going to run off and be with him or anything. Not that I would know where to find him. Oh, God, that didn't come out right."
She throws up her hands, giving up on the explanation.
"I'm sorry. This is weird."
"No, it's..." I cannot think of another word.
"Weird."
I shrug. "Okay, it's weird. And horrible."
"Loving a monster isn't bad."
"You didn't know when you fell in love with him, did you?"
"No."
"And you didn't fall in love with him because he was a monster, did you?" Now she shrugs, smiles. How would I know? I have no answer. 31. A church called the Fellowship of Hope has become a gathering place for anyone who wants to talk about Naomi, pray for her, or light a candle. It began with her friends and co-workers, perhaps started by that walrus-looking guy or the nasally girl, and now it has expanded to the wider community. I have not been inside the church, but I have stopped by on my way home from work and watched the people go in and out. Some stay a while, others just a few minutes. I recognize a few of them from the club, and I bet none of them had met Naomi. These are not the people who hang out with hotel desk clerks. Word gets back to Millicent, perhaps through one of her clients, and she decides our family should go to the church on Friday. That evening, we are all in a rush. I get home late from a lesson and jump in the shower. Rory went to a friend's house after school, but he forgot the time, and Millicent drives over to pick him up. Jenna is getting ready in her room. We have no time for dinner at home, so we'll go out after our visit to the church. Millicent starts a group text about which restaurant we will go to. Rory wants Italian, Millicent wants Mexican, and I do not care. When the car pulls into the garage, I call up to Jenna. Let's hit it, I say. Jenna always tells me I sound like such a dad when I say that. Now she says nothing. Jenna? When she doesn't answer the second time, I go upstairs and knock on her door. She keeps a small whiteboard on the door. It is decorated with rainbow-colored ribbons, and the words, "No, Rory," are written in her bubbly handwriting. Downstairs, the door to the garage opens, and Millicent calls out, "Ready?" "Almost," I say, and knock on the door again. Jenna does not answer. "What's going on?" Millicent says. The door is unlocked. I open it a few inches. "Jenna? Are you okay?"
"Yeah."
A tiny sound. It comes from the bathroom. In our home, no one has just a bedroom. We have suites with a bathroom attached. 4 bedrooms, 4.5 baths. This is how all homes are built in Hidden Oaks.
"Come on," Rory yells.
Millicent is walking up the stairs. I cross Jenna's bedroom through the childhood toys and the clothes, shoes, and makeup of a blossoming teenager. The door to the bathroom is open. Just as I look inside, Millicent appears in the hallway outside Jenna's room.
"What is going on?" she says.
Jenna stands on the white tile floor, with her feet surrounded by locks of dark hair. She looks at me, and her eyes seem larger than ever. Jenna has cut off all her hair, shorn down to the scalp, no more than an inch long. Behind me, Millicent gasps. She rushes past me to Jenna and holds her head with both hands.
"What have you done?"
she says. Jenna stares back, unblinking. I say nothing, though I know the answer. I know what Jenna has done. The realization makes me freeze. My body roots itself right into the persimmon-colored rug on Jenna's floor.
"What the?"
Rory is in the room now, staring at his sister, at the hair on the bathroom floor. Jenna turns to me and says,
"Now he won't take me, will he?"
"Jesus,"
Rory says. "Not Jesus. Owen." We do not go to church. We do not go out at all.
"A doctor,"
Millicent says.
"Our daughter needs a doctor."
"I know a doctor," I say. "He is a client."
"Call him." "No. Wait, maybe we shouldn't use one of your clients? Maybe we don't want them to know?"
"Know what?"
"That our daughter needs help."
We stare at each other, having no idea what to do. Surreal does not cover it. This is a new problem for us. An answer for everything can be found in child-rearing books. Millicent has them all. Physically sick, go to doctor. Not feeling well, go to bed. Faking it, go to school. Problem with another child, call their parents. Throwing a tantrum, give them a timeout. Not this problem, though. The books do not say what to do when your child is afraid of a serial killer, especially not one like this. We are in our bedroom, our voices low. Jenna is downstairs on the couch watching TV with a baseball cap on her head. Rory is with her. We have told him not to let his sister out of his sight. We also told him not to make fun. For once, he does as we say. Millicent decides to call our family doctor. Dr. Barrow is not a client. He is just a family practitioner we've been seeing for years. He treats our sore throats and tummy aches, checks for broken bones and concussions, but I do not think he can be helpful in this situation. He is a much older man who may or may not believe mental health is a real thing. It's late, I say to Millicent. He won't answer.
The service will call him. There's always a way to get hold of a doctor. Maybe we should... I'm going to call, she says. We have to do something.
Yes, I suppose we do. Millicent gives me a look as she picks up the phone. It is rare when I cannot decipher what her look means, but this is one of those times. If I had to guess, I would say it looks a bit like panic. I go downstairs to check on Jenna. Both she and Rory are on the couch. They are watching TV while eating sandwiches with potato chips stuffed between the bread. Jenna looks up at me. I smile at her, trying to convey that everything is fine, that she is fine, that the world is fine, and no one will hurt her. She looks away and takes another bite of her sandwich. I have failed to convey anything. Back upstairs, Millicent is on the phone. Her voice is too calm, too even, as she explains to an answering service that, yes, this is an emergency, and yes, she does need to speak with Dr. Barrow tonight. She hangs up, waits 5 minutes, and tries again. Dr. Barrow finally calls back. Millicent sounds rushed as she explains what has happened, what our daughter has done. She cannot get the words out fast enough. This is a crisis for her, for us, for our family. My part is in between. Jenna, the one in crisis. Millicent, the one doing something about it. Rory, the one staying out of the way, out of the line of fire. Me, the one running up and down the stairs, checking on everyone and deciding on nothing. I am in the middle again. 32. Dr. Barrow recommends a child psychologist, who agrees to meet us on Saturday for twice his usual fee. Everything in his office is beige, from carpet to ceiling, and it feels like we are in a bowl of oatmeal. The psychologist specializes in this kind of thing because it is a real thing, and he says Jenna does not feel safe. He suspects she has some kind of media-induced anxiety disorder, although the real name is irrelevant. So are the reasons she is acting out, which do not matter, because they do not make sense. Reason has no place here. You can explain that Jenna is safe until she repeats it in her sleep, but it won't make a difference. Millicent sits in front of the doctor, as close as possible. She spent the night in Jenna's room, barely slept, and she looks like hell. I look about the same. Jenna slept fine last night. Cutting off her hair seemed to bring her peace. When I try to tell the doctor this, he holds up his hand. False. False, I say. I try to mimic his tone, but the arrogance is too much. The peace is likely temporary, until some other piece of news sets her off again, he says. He has spent the last hour with Jenna, part of the emergency Saturday morning session arranged by Dr. Barrow. We are the second part.
What do we do? Millicent says.
He has some ideas for how to make Jenna feel safe. First, twice weekly appointments in his office. They are $200 apiece, no insurance accepted, cash or debit card only. Second, do everything you say you will do. Never let Jenna down. Never let her think you will not be there for her. But we don't, I say. We always... Always? He says.
At least 90% of the time, Millicent says. Maybe 95.
Make it 100. Millicent nods, as if she can wave a magic wand and this will happen.
Last, but certainly not least, he says, get her away from the media, from this serial killer, from all the stories about his victim. I realize I'm asking the impossible, especially in this day and age, but try to do it as much as possible. Don't watch the news at home. Don't discuss Owen or anything about him. Try to act as if he has nothing to do with your family.
He doesn't, I say.
Of course not.
We write the doctor a big check and leave. Jenna is in the waiting room. The TV on the wall is showing cartoons. She is staring at her phone. Millicent frowns. I smile and try my best. Who wants breakfast? The weekend is a flurry of meetings, with the whole family, with Jenna alone, with Rory alone, with both the kids, and with just Millicent. So many meetings with Millicent. By Sunday evening, we have a new set of rules, and they revolve around eliminating the news from our lives. All news programs are banned, as are newspapers. We will stream movies and avoid live TV as much as possible. No live radio. All of these are easy compared to the internet. The kids use it for school, for fun, for communication. Millicent tries anyway, beginning with the password. No one will be able to connect unless she does it herself. Mutiny.
Then I can't live here.
Rory goes for broke with his opening statement. Jenna nods, agreeing with her brother, a rare moment of solidarity. I agree with the kids. Millicent has proposed something that is impractical, unworkable, absurd, but I say nothing. Rory looks from me to his mother, sensing weakness. He lists all the reasons the password idea will not work, beginning with Millicent's long hours. Jenna finally pipes up.
I'll fail English.
That does it. English has been difficult for her this year. She has worked twice as hard at it to stay on the honor roll, and the idea of Jenna falling off it changes Millicent's mind. She downgrades to a lesser set of rules. Parental controls, laptops moved to the family room, all news apps removed from phones. Psychological rather than practical, but we all get the point. I have no idea if Jenna will follow the new rules. A hairdresser tries to shape what's left of Jenna's hair. Now that it's even, it does not look bad, just different. Millicent buys all sorts of hats and caps in case she wants to cover up. She lays them all out on the dining room table, and Jenna walks the length of it, trying on each one. At the end, she shrugs.
They're nice, she says. Do you have a favorite?
Millicent asks. Jenna shrugs again.
I'm not sure I need a hat.
Millicent's shoulders slump a little. She's more concerned about Jenna's hair than Jenna is.
Okay,
she says, gathering up the hats.
I'll just leave them in your room.
Before bedtime, I go see Rory. He is on his bed reading a comic book. He slides it under a pillow, and I pretend not to see it.
What?
He says. Irritation everywhere. I sit down at his desk. Books, notebooks, empty chargers, a full bag of chips, and a drawing of something that looks half monster and half hero. It's not fair, I say. None of this is your fault, but you have to live with it anyway.
Take one for the team. Got it.
What do you think? I say.
About what?
Your sister. He starts to say something. I can tell by those green eyes that he is going to be a smartass. But he stops, pauses.
I don't know,
he says.
She's been a little obsessed with this thing.
Owen.
Yeah, like more obsessed than usual. You know how she gets.
He is referring to Jenna's ability to laser focus on a topic, whether it be soccer or ribbons or ponies. Rory calls it obsession because he doesn't have it. How's she been at school? I say.
Fine, as far as I can tell. Still popular.
Can you let me know if anything changes? He thinks, perhaps, about asking for something in return.
Yeah,
he says. And don't be too much of an asshole to her.
But that's my job. I'm her brother.
Rory is smiling.
I know. Just don't be so good at it.
Millicent and I are finally alone late Sunday night. I am exhausted, worried. I dread the next story about Owen or Naomi or Lindsay. Naomi. For the first time in 2 days, it occurs to me that Millicent has not left our side. She has been with Jenna, me, us, since Friday night. It makes me wonder where Naomi is, if she is still alive. She must have water. She would not survive without that. I never wanted to think about where Naomi was, how she was restrained, what her surroundings were like. I forced myself not to think about it. Still, the images come, the ones I have heard about, the underground bunker or basement, the soundproof room in an otherwise normal home, restraints. I think about these as well, chains and cuffs made of steel so they cannot be broken. But it may not be like that. Maybe she's just locked in a room and free to roam around. It could be like a regular room with a bed, a dresser, a bathroom, maybe a refrigerator, comfortable and clean. Not a chamber of horrors or torture or any of those things. Maybe she even has a TV. Or not. I turn to Millicent, who is sitting up in bed, on her tablet, researching children who are afraid of what they hear on TV. Again, I think about asking her about Naomi. I want to know where and how Millicent is keeping her, but I'm afraid of what I might do with that information. I don't think I could control myself. If I know where she is, I will go to see her. I will have to. What if it's the worst-case scenario? What if she is chained to a radiator in a basement somewhere, covered in dirt and bleeding from torture? Because if that's what I see, I'm not sure what I would do. If I would kill her. If I would let her go. So I do not ask. 33. Bringing Owen back has served its purpose. No one doubts he is the one who kidnapped and killed Lindsay, the one who now has Naomi. Now it's time for him to fade away. The only way is to stop the news. No more letters, no more locks of hair, no more missing women, no more bodies. We need an exit strategy. Jenna needs it. At the club, they are still talking about Owen. I refuse. I get out of the clubhouse, away from the gossip, even away from Kikona. We still have 2 lessons a week, but she is at the club every day. I spend the whole day on the court, either with a client or waiting for the next one. After the past few weeks and the past weekend, the day is almost too normal. Something has to break it up. I have a lesson with a couple who has lived in Hidden Oaks since its inception. They are slow to move, but the fact that they can move at all is saying something. When we are done, the three of us walk up to the pro shop together. I want to get a coffee and get a look at my schedule for the week. The shortest route to the pro shop is through the clubhouse, which is where I see Andy. I have not seen him since before Trista left him. Back then, he looked like always, paunch around the middle, thinning hair, ruddy complexion from all that wine. Now he looks all wrong. He is leaning up against the bar, wearing sweatpants that look 100 years old. His cotton Hidden Oak shirt is brand new, still creased in the folds, as if he just bought it from the pro shop and put it on. He is clean-shaven, but his hair looks unkempt. The drink in his hand is brown and pure, no mixer, no ice. I walk up to him because he's my friend, or he was until I started hiding things from him. "Hey," I say. He turns to me but doesn't look happy. "Well, if it isn't the pro. The tennis pro, I mean, unless you're some other kind of pro. What's up?" "Oh, I think you know what's up." I shake my head, shrug, act like I have no idea what's going on. "You okay?" "No, not really. But maybe you should ask my wife about that. You know her pretty well, right?" Before he has a chance to say anything else, I take him by the arm. "Let's go get some air," I say. Thankfully, he does not protest. He does not say anything that could get me in trouble at work. We walk through the clubhouse and out the front door. We stand in an arched walkway. Ivy crawls up and around and down the other side. In one direction, the pro shop. The parking lot is in the other. I stop and face Andy. "Look, I don't know. Are you sleeping with my wife?" "Jesus, no. He stares at me, unsure.
Andy, I'd never sleep with your wife. Never.
His shoulders slump a little as the anger leaves him. He believes me.
But she's in love with someone else.
It's not me. I have no intention of telling him who it is.
But you see her all the time. Twice a week, right? She does take tennis lessons from you.
For a few years now, you know that. But she never mentioned having an affair. Andy narrows his eyes at me.
Is that the truth?
How long have we known each other?
Since we were kids.
And you think I'd be more loyal to Trista than to you?
Andy throws up his hands. I don't know. She was really upset about those missing girls. She won't watch the news anymore.
He looks down and scuffs his foot against the faux cobblestone.
You swear you don't know anything?
I swear.
All right. Sorry,
he says.
It's okay.
You want to grab some lunch or something?
I do not mention getting a drink. Not right now. I'm going to go home.
You sure?
He nods and walks away.
Andy does not go back into the clubhouse. He goes toward the parking lot. I start to tell him he cannot drive, but I don't. The valets will stop him. Liability and whatnot. My lessons continue. There is no news, no calls, no further disruptions. Not until I leave work and stop at the car wash on the way home. I normally check my phone, the disposable, at least every other day, but I broke my own rule. Too much going on, too many other things to deal with. The phone is hidden inside the spare tire in my trunk. At the car wash, I take everything out of the back so it can be vacuumed, grabbing the phone along with everything else. As the car goes through the wash, I turn on the phone. The new message beep startles me. Both the sound and the phone are old-fashioned. It's not even a smartphone, just a prepaid phone that is heavier than it looks. I bought it at a discount store years ago. It took me a while to decide. Not on the phone itself. Back then, all the prepaids looked the same. It took me a while to decide to get one in the first place. A nice saleswoman came along and asked if she could help. She looked too old to know a lot about electronics, but it turned out she knew everything. And she was so patient, so kind, and I asked one question after another. The answers did not matter. I did not care about the technical details. I was trying to decide if I wanted a second phone, the disposable kind, and I think I ended up with one because at some point it would have been rude not to buy something. I had taken up too much of her time. I have had this thing ever since. Annabelle is just the latest entry. I have not thought about her since deciding she would not be the one. There has been no reason to think about Annabelle, not until she called, or texted, I mean. It does not do any good to call a deaf man. Hey, stranger, let's have a drink again soon. Oh, and it's Annabelle. Smiley face. I have no idea when she sent the message. It does not arrive on my phone until I turn it on, but she could have sent it a week ago. At least a week has passed since I checked it. I consider answering the text, at least to say I was not ignoring her on purpose. My car is still being washed, so I scroll backward on the phone. Before the text from Annabelle, there is the one text from Lindsay, the one I ignored. It is now 15 months old. Had a great time the other day, Tobias. See you soon. Tobias. He was never supposed to have a personality of his own, and he wasn't supposed to sleep with anyone. Millicent and I came up with him together. It was on a rare cold night in Florida where the temperatures dipped below 40 degrees. Between hot cocoa and a pint of ice cream, Tobias was born.
You can't really change how you look, she told me. I mean, not without some kind of wig or paste-on beard.
I'm not wearing a wig.
So then you need something else.
I was the one who suggested pretending I was deaf. Just a few days before, I had taught a teenage kid who was deaf, and we used cell phones to communicate. It stuck with me, so I suggested it.
Brilliant,
Millicent said. She kissed me just the way I like it. Next, we discussed my name. It had to be memorable, but not weird. Traditional, but not common. It came down to two, Tobias and Quentin. I wanted the latter because of the nickname. Quint was better than Toby. We debated the pros and cons of both names. Millicent even pulled up the origins of them.
Tobias comes from the Hebrew name Tobiah, she said, reading from the internet. Quentin comes from the Roman name Quintus.
I shrugged. Neither origin meant anything to me. Millicent continued,
Quentin is from the Roman word for fifth. Tobias is a biblical name.
What did he do in the Bible?
Hang on. Millicent clicked and scrolled and said, he slayed a demon to save Sarah, and then he married her.
I want to be Tobias, I said.
Are you sure?
Who doesn't want to be the hero? That night, Tobias was born. Not many people have met him, just a few bartenders and a few women. Not even Millicent has met him. Tobias is almost like my alter ego. He even has his own secrets. I do not answer Annabelle's text asking me out for a drink. I shut off the phone and put it back in my trunk. 34. Christmas, 6 years ago. Rory was 8, Jenna was 7, and both had started asking why they only had one set of grandparents. I had never talked about my parents, never said anything about who they were or how they died. Their questions made me think about what I could say, what I should say. One night I went down to the kitchen, hoping that if I filled up my stomach it would make me sleepy enough to get past the insomnia. I ate leftover black bean casserole right out of the pan. Cold, but not half bad. I was still eating when Millicent came into the kitchen. She grabbed a fork and sat down with me.
What's going on? She said.
Millicent took a big bite of the casserole and stared at me, waiting. I never got up in the middle of the night to eat. She knew that. The kids are asking about my parents. Millicent raised her eyebrows, said nothing. If I lie and tell them their grandparents were wonderful, they'll hate me if they find out the truth, right?
Probably.
But they might hate me anyway.
For a while, she said. I think all kids go through a stage where everything will be our fault.
How long does it last?
She shrugs. 20 years?
I hope things are pretty quiet during that time. I smiled. She smiled. I could tell them my parents abused me, mentally, physically, even sexually. I could say they beat me, tied me up, burned me with cigarette butts, and made me walk to school and back uphill both ways. They did not. I grew up in a nice home in a nice area, and no one touched me the wrong way. My parents were refined, polite people who could recite manners in their sleep. They were also horrible, cold people who should not have become parents. They should have been smart enough to know a baby couldn't fix anything. The final straw came when I went overseas. When I told them I wanted to take a break from college and travel, they gave me some money. I bought an open-ended ticket and a large backpack and drank a few dozen shots. Andy and two other friends decided to join me, so we made a haphazard plan and set a date. I did not tell them or anyone that I was afraid. A few hours before the flight, I was still packing, still trying to decide which t-shirts to bring or if I needed a heavy jacket. Excited, yes, I was dying to get out of Hidden Oaks, dying to get away from my childhood bedroom, where the walls were painted to look like I was in the sky, surrounded by stars. I was tired of dreaming about what else was out there, and wanted to see it for myself. I also had no idea what would happen. I had already failed at tennis, then again at getting into a good college. Middle-of-the-road tennis player, middle-of-the-road grades. What would happen if I was middle-of-the-road while on the road? No idea. But it had to be better than feeling like I should never have been born. I'd hoped I would never return and never see those sky-painted walls again. My parents did not drive me to the airport. A cab picked me up because I was too embarrassed to ask for a ride from my friends and their parents. It was a Wednesday morning, my flight was early, and dawn had just started to break. My mother with her coffee cup, my father already dressed. All of us stood in the foyer on the shiny tile, surrounded by mirrors. The vase on the center table was filled with orange chrysanthemums. The rising sun hit the crystal chandelier above us, making a rainbow on the stairway. The cab honked. My mother kissed me on the cheek. My father shook my hand. "Dad, I want good luck," he said. I could not remember what I was going to say, so I left. It was the last time I saw them. In the end, I didn't lie to the kids. I said their grandparents died in a freak car accident and had been gone for many years. I did not tell them everything, but it was close. That was because of Millicent. Together, we decided how much to say. To make it as official as possible, we called a family meeting. Rory and Jenna were so young. Maybe it wasn't fair, but we did it anyway. We sat in the living room. Jenna was already in her yellow pajamas with the balloons all over them. She loved balloons, and Rory loved to pop them. Jenna's dark hair was cut to the chin, and she had bangs straight across her forehead. Her dark eyes peeked out from under them. Rory was wearing a blue t-shirt and sweatpants. When he'd turned 7, he had declared himself too old for pajamas. Millicent and I decided we could live with that, and she stopped buying them. It was hard to look at their tiny, trusting faces and tell them that sometimes people are better off not having kids. "Not everyone should be a parent," I said, "just like not everyone is nice." Jenna was the first to speak.
"I already know about strangers."
"Not everyone in your family is nice, or was nice." Scrunched up faces, confusion. I spoke for 10 minutes. That was all it took to tell my children their grandparents were not good parents. The irony of what I had done hit me years later, after Holly and the others. Someday, Rory and Jenna might have a talk with their kids and say the same thing about Millicent and me. 35. I had assumed the DNA testing on the lock of Naomi's hair would take longer than a week. Perhaps because it was always so fast on TV, I figured that their timing must be fake. That real DNA testing must take months. And apparently it does, but not for the preliminary tests, and not when the police are trying to find a woman who may still be alive. The tests indicate there is more than a 99% chance the hair belongs to Naomi. Kokona is the one who tells me all of this. Our regular tennis lessons become a class in forensics because her new hobby is true crime TV and documentaries. Missing and/or dead women are common on these shows.
"Always young, beautiful, and basically innocent," she says, ticking off the qualities one by one. She has a cup of coffee with her, and I do not think it is her first. "Although occasionally they have a case about a prostitute as a cautionary tale."
"Then what?" I ask.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, after this young, beautiful, and basically innocent woman goes missing, what happens?" Kokona holds up both her hands as if she is trying to quiet a loud audience.
"Option 1, the boyfriend, because he's jealous and possessive. Or the ex-boyfriend, because he's jealous and possessive."
"Was that all one option?"
"Yes. Pay attention. Option 2 is the stranger, or most likely a stranger. This is the psycho, stalker, sociopath, mentally ill, serial killer option. At least one of them. Maybe more."
Kokona is not telling me anything new. I watch TV too, but not the past day or so because the news is still banned in our house. I missed Josh's report about the DNA results, and I make a mental note to look it up online.
"Possible outcomes?"
Kokona says this as if I'd asked about them. I had not.
"Death? Rape and death? Torture and rape and death?"
Not much to say to that.
"Occasionally, one lives," she says.
"But not often?" Kokona shakes her head.
"Not even in fiction."
We go back to playing tennis. Eventually, I have another question for her. "Why do you think it's so popular, the missing woman story?"
"Because who can resist a damsel in distress?"
The news ban in our house has always been a little fake because all of us have the internet on our phones. Everyone knows the DNA results. After dinner, Millicent brings me into the garage, an impromptu date night. She wants to discuss the results with Jenna. It's been less than a week since the hair incident, but Jenna has seemed fine since then, even happy. Millicent is worried about a relapse. Into what, I am not sure. I am starting to think Jenna is being proactive, not paranoid, because who wants to be abducted by a psycho, stalker, sociopath, serial killer? Not my daughter. As we sit in the car, Millicent describes her plan for how we should approach the topic. We do not want to upset her, but we do not want to ignore the news. We do not want to talk down to Jenna, but we cannot be her friend. We want to discuss, but not lecture, to comfort, but not baby. Millicent keeps using the word we as if this plan is ours, not hers. How is she? I say.
Right now, she seems fine, but last week she seemed fine. And then...
I'm not talking about Jenna. She tilts her head, confused, annoyed, then clarity.
We're talking about Naomi, she says.
Is she still alive?
Yes.
I want to take that question back. I want to say something that makes Millicent laugh, that makes my adrenaline surge, that makes us both feel good. My mind is blank. We stare at each other, her eyes so dark they look like holes. I stare until I have to either stop or ask where Naomi is. I look away. Millicent exhales. I follow her back into the house. In the family room, we sit down on the couch where Jenna and Rory are watching TV. Rory is the first to notice that we are looking at them, not the TV. He does not stick around for the talk. It goes well, I think. Jenna listens and nods and smiles. When Millicent asks if she has any questions, Jenna shakes her head. When I ask how she feels, she says, fine.
Are you scared?
Millicent says. Jenna reaches up and touches her short hair.
No. Owen won't hurt you.
I know.
The irritated tone is reassuring. She sounds normal and looks normal, except for her hair. Later, Millicent and I are in our room. She is organizing, walking back and forth between the bedroom and the closet, putting some things away and taking out others. She fixes everything before bed so the mornings are easier. Frantic is not her thing, nor is being late. I watch. Her red hair is loose, messy, and she keeps brushing it back with one hand. She wears thermals, the nubby, old-fashioned kind, and striped socks. Her nighttime clothes are the least fashionable thing about her, and I have told her how dorky they are. But I do not say that tonight. Instead, I go down the hall and check on Jenna. She is asleep, nestled between the orange sheets under the white comforter. Her face is relaxed, peaceful, not afraid. Back in our room, Millicent has just gotten into bed, and I get in beside her. She looks at me, and I think she's going to mention our earlier talk in the garage. Instead, she turns out the light, like it meant nothing. I wait until her breathing slows, then get up and check on Jenna again. The second time I get up, I do not bother going back to bed. Throughout the night, I check on her three more times. During the hours in between, I watch TV. Around 2 in the morning, I doze off while watching an old movie. When I wake up, I see Owen's face. A documentary about him is on TV. Several of these shows have been made with varying levels of detail about Owen's crimes. I have managed to avoid them, just as I avoided reading about what Owen did to his victims. This time I cannot, because I wake up at exactly the wrong time. Just as I see Owen's face on the screen, the show cuts away. The next thing I see is the room where he kept each one of his victims. The video had been made for Owen's trial, which never happened. It is 15 years old and filmed with a handheld camera that shakes too much. Owen had gutted an abandoned rest stop, knocking down the wall between the men's and women's restrooms. The tiled floors might have been white, but now were a grayish brown. One toilet remained, along with a sink, a mattress, and a table. Pipes ran up and down the cutout walls. They started deep in the ground and ran across the ceiling, down the other side, and back into the cement floor. They were the perfect size for handcuffs. A pair is still attached to one of the pipes. The video jerks and zooms in on the floor. The blood was not visible in the wider angle. Now I see a smattering of blood here, a few drops there. The red spots are everywhere, as if someone had flung a brush of red paint at the floor. The camera moves across the floor into a corner. A larger amount of blood is smeared on the wall. It is down low, inches from the ground, as if whoever was bleeding had been crouched down. The angle moves again, toward the mattress. I imagine Naomi lying on it. I change the channel. 36. 2 days pass before I hear about Trista. Millicent is the one who tells me. It is Saturday evening. Rory is upstairs, and Jenna is staying over at a friend's house. As soon as they are out of sight, I flop down on the couch and put my feet on the table. This is not allowed, not for me or the kids, but when Millicent sits down next to me, she does not mention it. This makes me remove my feet without being asked. It is that weird. What's wrong? I say. She puts her hand on mine, and now I'm worried, panicked even. Millicent, just...
It's Trista, she says.
Trista?
Her sister called me earlier. Andy is too upset to talk to anyone.
Her sister? Why would her...
She committed suicide.
I shake my head as if my ears aren't working, as if she didn't just say Trista killed herself.
I'm so sorry,
Millicent says. I realize this is real, and it knocks the wind out of me.
I don't understand. From what she said, neither does anyone else, especially Andy.
How? I say.
She hung herself on the shower rod.
Oh, God.
I knew they were having problems, but I had no idea she was so upset.
Millicent has no idea what the real reason is, because I never told her about Trista, never mentioned she had dated Owen, and was still in love with him. My dinner feels like it is burning a hole in my stomach. I run to the bathroom and throw it all up. Millicent is at the door asking if I am okay. I say yes, even as the dry heaving starts. Too much food, I tell her. She reaches down and checks my forehead. It is not warm. I sit down on the floor against the wall and wave my hand, letting her know I am fine. She walks away. I close my eyes, listening to her in the kitchen, rummaging through the refrigerator, hunting for whatever made me sick. I want to tell her it is us. We have a daughter who brought a knife to school and has cut off all her hair. Now a woman is dead. Not Naomi, a different woman. Because of Owen. Because of me. I wrote those letters to Josh. Millicent runs back into the bathroom with a bottle of the pink medicine. I chug it down and get sick all over again. The funeral service is held at Alton's funeral parlor, the same place Lindsay's was held. I did not attend hers, but read about it. Lindsay had a closed casket because of what Millicent had done to her. Trista has an open casket. Andy is still her husband, and he arranged everything. The room is large, and every chair is filled. I think Trista would have been pleased to know her funeral is standing room only. Everyone is here, dressed in their finest black clothing, either to pay their respects or to gawk. I am here because I am responsible. Millicent is with me, though she still has no idea why Trista killed herself. Neither does anyone else. For days, people at the club have talked about the breakup of her marriage, depression, money problems. At any given moment, she could be a drug addict, an alcoholic, a nymphomaniac. She was pregnant, or had been, but lost the baby. Maybe she was dying anyway, a terminal disease or a brain tumor. No one seemed to remember or even know she had dated Owen Oliver Riley some 20 years ago. Her sister is at the service. She is a heavier, brunette version of Trista. She says Trista used to take care of her while their parents worked. She fixed dinner and did their laundry.
We grew up on the other side of town. She didn't always live in Hidden Oaks.
It sounds like an insult. Trista's younger sister still lives on the other side of town. She does not mention Andy. Next is one of Trista's more recent friends. She is as thin and blonde as Trista was, and she tells a long story about how Trista was always willing to listen, help, and pitch in whenever she could. The last one to speak is Andy. He has cut his hair since the last time I saw him, and he is wearing a dark suit instead of sweatpants. He talks about how he met Trista. She was an unpaid intern at a museum, still looking for a job that used her art history degree. He was there attending a benefit, and their paths crossed in front of a sculpture. She told him all about it.
I was enchanted. By her, by the way she spoke and what she said, and even the tone of her voice. I can't think of a better word. Trista was simply enchanting.
Andy breaks down as he says this. First tears, then sobs. No one moves. I look away. This makes me feel sick all over again. Andy's brother walks up to him and whispers in his ear. Andy takes a deep breath and collects himself. He keeps talking. I do not listen. I am thinking about that word. Enchanting. When he is done, we have a chance to walk by the coffin to say our final goodbyes to Trista. Just about everyone does. Only a few hang back. Millicent and I do not. The coffin is made of wood so dark it is almost black, and the interior is pale peach. It is not as bad as it sounds. The color complements Trista's blonde hair and that apricot lipstick. She looked good in that color, and I am glad someone knew to put it on her. But her outfit is the opposite. It is a solid dark blue with long sleeves. A single strand of pearls hangs from her neck, and she has pearl studs in her ears. None of this looks like Trista. It looks like someone bought the outfit yesterday because they thought she should be buried in something dignified instead of something she would have liked. It upsets me, unnaturally so. I do not like to think of Trista spending eternity in an outfit she hates. I hope she is not looking down on this funeral. She looks beautiful, Millicent says. If I could say something to Trista, I would tell her I am sorry. Sorry for the clothes, for asking her about Owen, for bringing Owen back. I would also tell her that Andy is right. She was enchanting. I know this because